Coming to you from the Arctic wasteland of the Fortress of Solitude, this is the Ninth Long Box Graveyard Podcast. My name is Paul O'Connor. I'm your host for the next hour or so. I'll catch you up on the happenings at my Long Box Graveyard comic book blog. And I'll also bring you this month's feature, which is A Tale of Two Pitches. Thank you for listening, as always, whether you're a new or a returning listener. And if you're a returning listener, I hope you tell your friends about the Long Box Graveyard Podcast, which comes to you monthly, hosted by the great people over at the We Talk Comics Podcast Network. I sat here a month ago and told you that my blog readership was up, that I had five straight weeks of increasing gains, and of course, stating your plans is a way to hear God laugh. No sooner did I publish those remarks than bang! My blog viewership pancaked. I put this down to two factors. One was that you guys really didn't like my Instagram post very much, and that's okay. But the other one, and the one I think it's more useful, is I'm beginning to think that page load speed has everything to do with traffic at Longbox Graveyard. You may remember that I turned off ads a couple months ago on the blog because I thought it was slowing down my load speed, and as soon as I turned the ads off, the viewership took off. Well, this last week I published a blog about the Defenders, which maybe is not a terribly popular subject, but it's not so unpopular as to explain why my viewership just dropped off the cliff. And looking back on it, I think probably the page was just loading too slow. I was breaking in a new scanner, and I believe I set the DPI too high, and as a result, the images are heavier than would normally be the case, and it was really slowing down the page load, I think. So this morning I went in and made some adjustments to improve the speed of the page, and bang, readership took off like crazy. So in future, I'm going to try to display a little less on that front page. I won't have any legacy posts up necessarily. I'll have to click through to find anything other than the current page, but that should improve load speeds, and hopefully we'll get more people looking at the site. Which is as good an excuse as any is to talk about what went on at Longbox Graveyard since last we were together. Looking back, excuse me, of course, you can always find these blogs at www.longboxgraveyard.com. There's a new blog every Wednesday. So what's been going on there on Wednesdays for the last month? Well, on the 16th of January, I published a blog called Farewell to the King. And this was a look back at Jack Kirby's last run on Captain America at Marvel Comics in the mid-1970s. Not an especially great run of comics, but hey, it's Jack Kirby. I'll take bad Kirby over someone else's best work most days. Farewell to the King looked specifically at the end of his run, which was the origin and the very weird story surrounding Arnim Zola. This was a popular blog, got a lot of hits, a lot of nice comments. If you haven't checked it out, it's still up, of course. Farewell to the King from the 16th of February. On the 23rd of that same month, excuse me, 16th of January. On the 23rd of January, I published the top 10 superheroes on Instagram, about which the less said the better, because it did not do so well. Basically, what I was doing was I've been using Instagram since the middle of last year, and I was looking at what images have been working there, which did not, based on likes. So there's some cool images there. Check them out. And if you're interested in Instagram or what kind of superhero comic book culture is growing up on Instagram, check out the post. Of course, you can find me on Instagram as longbox_graveyard. On the 30th of January, I published Who Remembers Scorpio? And this was a look at Defenders number 48 through 50 by Keith Giffen and David Anthony Kraft, which I thought was a terrific little run of Defenders books. If you read the blog, you'll find out why. Just be a little patient as it loads, because I think the pages are too big. On the 6th of February, I published a blog about Star-Lord. And in this, I had a rare bit of karma. The blog went live the day after Chris Pratt was announced as getting the role of Star-Lord in Marvel's forthcoming Guardians of the Galaxy movie from 2014. So that made this topic about a comic book from 1976 suddenly seem relevant. Anyway, I tell you all about Star-Lord, the original Star-Lord, the Star-Lord that appeared first in Marvel Preview number 4, Black and White magazine, in 1976. I always liked the guy. So check out that blog from the 6th of February, Star-Lord, to find out why I thought that character was kind of cool. And then on the 13th of February, which may be in your future, if you downloaded this podcast on its first day of availability, on the 13th, I initiated a new feature at Longbox Graveyard called By Any Other Name. In this case, it's By Any Other Name, Darkseid. And that kind of defeats the purpose of the whole blog, which is, how do you pronounce that character's name? Is it Darkseid or is it Darkseid? Well, I have an opinion, and I think there's even a correct answer, but I'm curious what you think So check out the blog by any other name, Dark Side, from the 13th of February, where there's a poll and you can vote and tell me what your opinion is and how to say that character's name. And in the month ahead at Longbox Graveyard, we'll also have features on the 1980s Ralph Bakshi and Frank Frazetta film Fire and Ice, and also a look at the way various authors have handled the death of Superman in comic books, specifically comparing and contrasting All-Star Superman by Grant Morrison with Alan Moore's Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. Those are coming up later in the month of February. And that'll take us up to the next Longbox Graveyard podcast, which will be about I don't know what, but I do know about this month's broadcast, which is A Tale of Two Pitches. Before I get to it, I should note that due to technical reasons, too tedious to recount, I've already recorded the section you're about to hear about A Tale of Two Pitches, and I am now recording the intro for it out of order, which means nothing for you because it's all going to be in order once Mo splices this together. But I bring it up because having just listened to the monologue just now, it occurred to me that I talk a lot about pitching. I talk about the circumstances of a couple different pitches I made, and I talk about the outcomes of those pitches. But what I don't talk about is the pitches themselves. I don't really describe them. But maybe that's appropriate, because a pitch isn't a story. A pitch is a story about a story. And in that regard, I think the section you're about to hear works well. But if you're hoping for the juicy details of my pitches with a couple people you probably know, certainly one person you know from the film business, I apologize, I didn't give you more juicy details. Hopefully you'll still enjoy the section anyway, so let's get to it. It's going to be A Tale of Two Pitches. Hope you like it, and then I'll jump back in at the end of the podcast here. We'll do the news, and we'll get out of here for the month. Okay, here we go. A Tale of Two Pitches. This month's feature is called A Tale of Two Pitches, and it's a bit of a departure for me at the Longbox Graveyard podcast. It's going to be a little more autobiographical, maybe, than past discussions, and it's also going to be more extemporaneous. I'm working without a script. Normally, I have at least some bullet points down about what I want to talk about, but I'm going to talk off the top of my head on this one, both to be more spontaneous and also because it's appropriate to the subject, because the art of pitching is the art of knowing what to say when no one else knows what to say. Some of you may know that I wrote comic books in my past life. It was a short and not especially distinguished career, but it did give me an opportunity to understand the comics field from inside for a little while, and also to develop original ideas. I developed a number of them for Malibu Comics in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And if you're interested in the books that I wrote, I'll put a note in, or put a link in the show notes where you can go to a past blog entry where I look in detail all the various books I wrote at that time. My life as a comic book writer is neither here nor there. It's germane to this, however, because I'm going to talk about two pitches that I made, neither one of which were directly comic book pitches per se, but both of which were related to the comic book business, both of which were related to specific comic book properties. In addition to being a comic book writer for a brief period of time, most of my professional life has been spent designing games. I began my game design career in the early 1980s. I started doing paper and pencil role-playing game supplements. My first publication when I was 18 years old was Grimtooth Traps, one of the first universal or generic role-playing supplements ever published. And that book's still in print all these years later, 30 years later. At various times, I also worked for a number of video game and computer game companies. I worked for Interplay and helped them ship a game called Dragon Wars. I was the lead designer on the first two Oddworld games, Oddworld's Abe's Odyssey and Oddworld Abe's Exodus, both on PlayStation 1. And since then, I've also gone on and done additional video game work, helping found High Moon Studios, where we made Dark Watch, Bourne Conspiracy. And I'm presently engaged in iPhone development for a company called Appy Entertainment. So most of my creative life has been spent doing games. And each one of these pitches were in the game field that I'm going to talk about today, but they were comic book related. Now, this wasn't a show I planned to do. Mo Christensen, who is my boss at We Talk Comics, said that I should do it because he thought it'd be interesting because there's some famous names attached to these pitches. And also, well, you get to hear my humiliation on at least one of the pitches and maybe what I learned from it. So before I tell you about these two pitches, one of which was with a feature head of Marvel Comics and another of which was with Steven Spielberg, let me tell you about pitching and its importance and what I know about it. I wasn't a very good comic book writer, and I'm a good, occasionally very good, game designer. But one thing I can say with confidence is I'm a pretty good pitch man. I don't necessarily close a deal, but I can open one like a son of a gun. And you give me an opportunity to talk, I can generally get people's confidence. And that's a big part of pitching. Often the reason you're doing a pitch in the first place is because you have a complex idea that needs to be distilled down to a few simple concepts. It's inherently a communication puzzle, a means of communicating complex things to people in short, easily digestible bites. And also use vivid language that helps cement the concept in your listener's imagination and maybe leads them to believe they understand it, even if they don't. I mean, any pitch is going to, especially in video games, you're talking about a very complex experience that may be 10, 15, 20 hours long with extraordinarily difficult engineering, art, breakthroughs in game mechanics. And you can't possibly encapsulate all that in a pitch. So what you have to do is come up with kind of a summary, or at least a convey the spirit of the idea in as few words as possible so you don't lose your audience. You're also often pitching to people that are themselves not technical or not terribly interested in the details of your project. One of the secrets is people don't bet on projects so much as they bet on people. So by pitching an idea, you hopefully will leave them with the impression that you at least understand what you're talking about, even if they don't. And if they think that you're enthusiastic enough about your idea and understand it in sufficient depth, then they'll have confidence to greenlight your idea and allow you to go forward, at least to a prototype stage. So I'm going to talk about two pitches here. The first one was in the, I want to say it was the early 1990s. I'm a little fuzzy on the date. It was near the end of my time with Malibu Comics. At Malibu, I worked as a freelancer. I was never on staff, and I wrote several comic books for them. But in the early 90s, there was a phenomenon called Magic the Gathering, a collectible card game that I'm sure you're familiar with. And it really was a publishing phenomenon. It found a way to sell blindly collectible packs to people, and it reinvigorated the card business and the game business. It was a phenomenon and a spectacularly good game. So in the gold rush that followed the release of Magic the Gathering, Every game company, every publishing house had the bright idea of releasing a collectible card game of their own. And one day I got a phone call from my friend and editor-in-chief at Malibu, Chris Ulm, and he said, "We want to do a collectible card game based on our Ultraverse line of characters." Now, the Ultraverse came about at the tail end of Malibu's existence, and I had only a peripheral association with the Ultraverse on a creative level. I wrote a couple fill-in issues of Rune, a fill-in issue of Sludge. I wrote some advertising editorial material for a giveaway magazine called Ultra Monthly. But I was unable to get on board with the Ultraverse, which was a disappointment to me because that's where the good pay was, and that was the high-profile, full-color superhero books. So to have an opportunity to get involved with Ultraverse, even as a game designer, was something that I was ready to leap at. At the time, I was working in video games. I think I was working with a company called Alexander Incorporated out in Los Osos, California. They were a precursor to Oddworld. And it wasn't an especially happy job. And I wasn't especially well tasked there either. So I had the cycles to bite off a big freelance project. And this project intrigued me because I liked playing Magic the Gathering. And I instantly saw how a similar game might be built up around the superhero characters of the Ultraverse. And likewise, I could see how the game might be merchandised and marketed. It was a perfect combination. We could ship comic books with cards embedded in the spines or polybagged. It was an opportunity to drive players to buy the comics. It was also an opportunity to drive comics readers to try the game. And this, of course, was back in the days before the market was flooded with these collectible card games. And it was also before it became evident to everyone that it was difficult to catch lightning in a bottle twice. I think you all looked at magic and thought it would be an easy thing to reproduce. We didn't recognize that game's particular genius. So, it wasn't just me. Plenty of people tried to climb that mountain with varying degrees of success. So, with more ambition than skill, I agreed to do this game, which we called Ultra Cards. And I developed it, and I played it with my pals at Alexandria, the game developer, who were already playtesting Source for me, because we were all playing collectible card games over lunch anyway. And the game had a few breakthrough aspects to it that I'm still proud of that are neither here nor there, so I won't go into them. Suffice to say, it was a reasonably sophisticated game. It was probably too complex for the market. I didn't have the math figured out at all. I didn't understand how rarities or distributions would work. I kind of waved my hand through that part. That's part of the skill of a pitch. I figured I'd figure that out later. I concentrated on the things I understood and also upon the problems that interested me, which was the design of the game. In this, I was assisted by Dan Danko, an editor at Malibu, who was a terrific partner in the development of the game, with good ideas and insight on the design, and also an ace production hand. Dan had plenty of experience in laying out cards. He was the primary liaison, I believe, at Malibu for the trading card sets that they were producing at the time through Skybox, which was, at that time, the number two trading card company in the world, or at least in the United States. This was before the bottom fell out, and there was still a reasonable market for things like sports cards and non-sport trading cards. So Dan was armed with the knowledge of how to make really slick and good-looking playtesting decks in a hurry, and I, allegedly, had the game design smarts. The two of us, well, we formed a team that couldn't miss. So we developed this game called Ultra Cards, tested it, and took it to, I guess in software terms, you might call it an alpha prototype. I managed to play it with a few people, played it with the editorial staff at Malibu, played it with my friends, and we were onto something. Given time and money and patience, it may have been polished into a good game. Then came the first of many curveballs on this particular project. Malibu Comics, at the end of its existence, of course, was purchased by Marvel Comics. And this Ultra Cards project must have overlapped in some way. At least Malibu was on speaking terms with Marvel. No, it must have been after the purchase. It's the only way it made any sense. See, I told you I was talking extemporaneously here. Anyway, when Marvel bought Malibu, a number of plans changed. And one of the biggest plans that changed was our plans to publish Ultra Cards. Suddenly, the Ultraverse wasn't the biggest fish in town, or the biggest fish in the sea anymore. Now we had access to the Marvel Universe. And my boss at Malibu, my ultimate boss there, Scott Rosenberg, said, "Hey, why don't you expand this Ultra Cards game and bring in all these Marvel characters as well? We have permission. Go ahead and do it." Now, at this point, I have to digress and unpack a little bit what I know about Scott Rosenberg. Scott is a controversial figure in the comics business, and with good reason, to be fair. I'm not going to go into those reasons here. You do a Google search for Scott Rosenberg, especially Scott Rosenberg Platinum Productions, and you'll get an eyeful of Scott's current business and the troubles surrounding it. Its greatest success is it's known for the company that brought us Cowboys and Aliens, which unfortunately was not as successful a picture as any of us would have liked. But what Scott has been able to do effectively is remain in business, attract investors, develop properties, and get some of them sold into Hollywood. All things I haven't done. Scott ran Malibu Comics, and even in those days, of course, he had his detractors. Didn't care for his business practices or maybe his personality. For my part, Scott treated me great. I mean, he was always kind to me and always paid me on time. He was always considerate of me. I don't have a bad word to say about Scott. But where there's smoke, there's fire, and there's a lot of smoke around Scott right now. And I hope that gets resolved. Excuse me. The last time I saw Scott was at the Malibu Comics retrospective panel that I hosted at San Diego Comic-Con in 2012. And to be honest, that wasn't his best day. I was happy to see him. I think he was happy to see us. He was on stage with other Malibu Comics old-timers, including Chris Ulm, Dave Ulbrich, Tom Mason. And while the other guys are fairly focused, Scott was a little ill-focused that day. And I'm not sure he's really on the same page with us in terms of what we were trying to do on the panel. But Scott was always a little flighty that way. Seems like he's only gotten more so. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. I give you this background only so that you understand that A, Scott was my boss at the time, and B, Scott was aggressive in making deals. Scott would assume things would work out for the best. And Scott had no problem sending people on missions with little chance of success. And now you see how this wraps back into the pitch story. All right, so we have this game called Ultra Cards. We have a merger or a purchase that's occurred between Marvel and Malibu. We have Malibu Comics that's fighting for its own position inside this new Marvel empire and is trying to retain its autonomy. And it turns out that Marvel Comics has their own collectible card game in development. Development is being coordinated at FLIR, the number one trading card company in North America. And FLIR is under the direction of a gentleman named Bill Gemmis at that time. Bill's another name you may know from comic books. I think Bill's a real interesting cat. I wish I got a chance to know him a little bit better. I would have learned more from him. Looking at his Wikipedia page here, which of course we know is true, I see Bill had a background in law. He worked with the National Basketball Association for a while. He came to FLIR and was in charge of that company and did very well. And then from the following through and the chaos that followed at Marvel Comics, by hook or by crook, Bill found himself running Marvel along with Joe Quesada. And some things that came out of that period of time were Marvel Knights line, the Marvel Max line. Marvel was in a lot of trouble when those guys took over, and I think they left the company generally better than they found it. Another thing Bill was involved with, or perhaps responsible for, was the launch of the Ultimate lines of comics, which at the time I recall being fairly controversial. People thought it represented a fatal dumbing down of the Marvel Universe, or might be confusing because it was a parallel line. Also some fanish fear that the Ultimates were going to replace the mainline comics, you know, all the usual stuff. Looking back on it, it seems crazy that it would be controversial to suggest that you create a line of comic books that would be recognizable to people that were coming to your properties from film. After all, the film version of Spider-Man, X-Men were considerably different than what you could get in the comic books in those days. But in the face of much resistance, they launched this line anyway. It ended up being very successful, largely due to the extraordinary writing talent that was involved in the Ultimates line. And over time, the Ultimates ended up becoming as confused and as encumbered as the continuity they were intended to replace or supplement, but we can't lay that at Bill's feet. He was long gone by then. He was a controversial figure while he was at Marvel. He wrote some bad books. He didn't really do himself a lot of favors with the fan press. He said things that upset people. This is entirely in character with the Bill Gemmis that I knew, however briefly. Bill was a hard-nosed guy, East Coast guy, but also an interesting guy. I see here on his Wikipedia page that after he left Marvel, looks like he ended up on the wrong side of people during the power struggles for Marvel in the 1990s. After he left the company, I assume he didn't get hurt bad, but most of these executives have got pretty good golden parachutes. He's gone on to other projects, including Bible translation. Interesting guy. And actually, his path crossed with my company, Appy Entertainment, a few months ago, and Chris got a chance to talk to him. I suspect maybe I'll get a chance to sit down and tell this story to Bill someday if he's interested. But roll it back. Early 90s. I'm 30 years old. At that time, Bill's about, he's not that much older than I am. 4 or 5 years older than me. It seemed a lot older. And he certainly had his crap together better because he was running this big company on the East Coast. There's a convention on the East Coast, New York City, big collectible card game convention. They're having a major Magic tournament. And, Bill's going to be there along with his company, FLIR. And Scott sends me a plane ticket, and he sends Dan Danko and I out to New York to meet with Bill. And says, listen, they already have a game in development out there, but they want to take a look at your game, and if it's the better game, then that's the one they're going to publish. And you know, you have this, we have this great card engine. We have a lot of faith in it. We think it's going to be successful. You've incorporated the Marvel characters. Go out there and knock their socks off. So it's like, okay, sure. So I hopped on a plane, flew to New York, and Dan and I went to this convention, and we went up to, I think Bill had a suite there that he was, that he had booked for the weekend at the hotel. I forget which one it was, but, you know, he's doing business. And, Dan and I showed up at the appointed time, and Bill said, "Who are you?" I said, "Well, I'm Paul O'Connor. This is Dan Danko. We're out from California. We're from Malibu Comics." He said, "Who? What? Malibu what?" And I said, "You know, Scott Rosenberg sent us out here. We have an appointment, 3 o'clock. We're supposed to talk to you about this game." He said, "I don't know what you're talking about. Scott Rosenberg sent you out here? I don't have a deal with Scott. What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, you know, I have this game that I want to show you, this collectible card game that we're working on. That I understand you have a game in development." He said, "I can't look at your game. I don't have a deal with Scott. I don't have a contract with Scott. I can't even talk to you. You're not even supposed to be here." And then he said, and I'll always remember this, he said, "What's Rosenberg think he's doing? We can't talk unless we have a deal in place. We're running with our shoes untied." He said, "We're running with our shoes untied." And basically tried to throw me out of his suite. That's not the way you want a pitch to start. You know, normally they bring you a bottle of water or something. But, you know, Bill said that, you know, we were clowns, that we had no business being there, we're running with our shoes untied, and that Scott was out of his mind. So that's where the relationship started. And that was really my first experience with the way Scott would just kind of put you in harm's way and then assume things would work out. Or the Scott Rosenberg reality distortion feel that in his mind, maybe he thought he had a deal. Maybe he thought I had a meeting. Maybe he thought Bill was eager to see us. Looking back on it now, I understand he was just overplaying his hand. And I was it. I thought I was walking in there with a pair of aces, and instead I was a busted flush. But, you know, we held our ground and said, "Look, Bill, we flew out here from California, came across the country. You can at least let me see the game." And he said, "Well, no, but hang on a second." And he had his family there with him, as I recall, or at least he had a young child. I assume it was his baby. I hope it was his baby. And I remember Bill handed me the baby and said, "Here," walked out. And it was before I had kids, and I didn't know how to hold kids or anything. So I'm sitting there in this hotel room, a little jet-lagged, Danko looking a little shell-shocked. Have no idea why I'm here or why this guy's shouting at me and how I ended up holding a baby. You know, it was good I had the baby because it stopped me from just having my dick in my hands, which is about all I had at that point. So Jemis went in the other room and made a phone call, I think, and then, you know, came back and said, "Get out of here. We don't have a deal. Get out. Get out." So I gave him back his baby, and Dan and I left, and I went and I got on the phone with, I tried to call Scott. I think I probably got through to Chris Ulm out in California and basically said, "What the heck? What's going on out here?" And Chris said, "Let me try to figure it out." So a flurry of phone calls went back and forth, and eventually we got our audience with Bill. So I went back into the room and I did my best to pitch the game, and I probably didn't do that great a job. At the time, as a game designer, I still mostly focused on the idea and the mechanics, and with Ultra Cards, I'm sure he immediately detected that this thing was too hard for his target market. He didn't understand it, and if Bill couldn't understand it, certainly no one else can understand it, which is a defect that smart and creative people have sometimes. So I pitched the game, and he was very patient about it, noncommittal and grunted and this and that. And I think he basically ran me out of the office again, explaining that, you know, he's already got a game. It's a great game. I don't need your game. What do I need your game for? And I said, "Well, maybe my game's better, or maybe your game can benefit from ideas from my game." And trying to keep my cool and be reasonable as this guy was chewing me out. He basically threw me out of the office again, I think, after I gave my pitch. And Dan and I were down in the lobby sitting there kind of shell-shocked, wondering, "Oh, what just happened?" And I remember thinking, "Look, we can't let people see us as failures. Let's get out of here." That was something that Tom Mason at Malibu used to always say. "Never let them see you sweat," he used to say. And I was feeling the same way. I mean, we were feeling pretty dejected. No one was interested in our game. Everybody else was playing Magic. We really felt like just, you know, schlubs. So Dan and I went out and got a cab, and like we went to the art museum and, you know, spent a day in New York. Went to dinner that night and figured, what the heck. So Bill stole me out of the office. He's not interested in the game. Scott has kind of hung me out to dry. feeling pretty foolish. This game that I've been working on for weeks and, you know, for months is looks like it's going to crash and burn. And then that night we get a call at the hotel, and it's Scott. And Scott says, okay, Paul, now look, I want you to be very calm. I've worked everything out. Bill wants to see you tomorrow at FLIR in Philadelphia. You have a meeting. Well, really? Well, that's interesting. I want you to extend your trip for a day and go out there and see him. So I did that. I phoned in sick to my my video game job in California, and Dan and I arranged to stay an extra day. And the next day, we rented a car in Manhattan, and Dan drove us out to Philadelphia, which I thought was very brave. I was afraid to drive in Manhattan then. I would be now as well. I remember Dan got a ticket on the Jersey Turnpike, which was kind of funny. I hope he had the sense to charge it as an expense to Scott. Anyway, we go out to FLIR's headquarters in Philadelphia someplace, and we get there. We get there fairly late in the day, as I recall. I think we stayed over one more day until we could see Bill. I remember that we went to see the Liberty Bell and did some other cool things. The only night I was in Philadelphia, I'd like to go back. Anyway, eventually I'm having my meeting with Bill, one-on-one. And we're in Bill's office at FLIR. And he's sitting in his chair. I remember sitting in his chair. He has his office. It's all full of sports memorabilia because he was an NBA guy. And, of course, FLIR was very big in sports cards at that time. So it's all, you know, all the images are there, the Magic Johnson jerseys and all these trappings of power in that particular era and business. And Bill's sitting behind his desk. And he's in a chair that pivots back and forth. And he's kind of leaned back in his chair, but he's got his feet down on the floor, and he's up on his toes, and he's kind of rocking his legs up and down on his toes, and he's simultaneously twisting back and forth at the waist. So he's very energetic, and also very distractible, and his mind's kind of leaping from one idea to the next. And he said another thing to me I'll never forget. And remember, this is just after throwing me out of his office twice and telling me that I was, you know, he didn't need me, didn't need my game. He said, Paul, you're one of the smartest guys in the business, and that's why we want to work with you. It was just so brazenly false. It was so funny. It was very Hollywood. And I also understand that he was no more sincere about thinking I was the smartest guy in the business and wanted to work with me than he was sincere in throwing me out of his office the day before. It was all negotiation for Bill, and that was also his background. He was a very hard-nosed negotiator. But anyway, that passed his affection for his kind. I'm the smartest guy in the business. That's why he wants to work with me. So he says, tell me again. Pitch me your idea. So I pitch him the idea, and he's asking more questions now. He's more engaged. And he says they already have a design that's nearly done, and why should my game be better? And I tried to answer those questions as well. And then he did one more thing that was really just kind of the denouement of this whole strange odyssey. He leaned over on his desk and he picked up a marker. It was an El Marco pen. It was a black El Marco pen. And he held it up in front of me, kind of leaned in. In my memory, I envision it as this gigantic kind of fisheye lens experience where he's looming large in my field of vision. And he's leaning in with this El Marco pen. And he says, Paul, I could put X-Men on this El Marco pen and sell a million copies of it. What do I need you and your game for? And I said, well, you know, if it's a good game, maybe you'll sell 2 million copies instead of one. That seemed to appeal to him. And I left the office not knowing what had happened. Did I have a deal? Didn't I have a deal? I'm not sure. Well, you probably know the answer because you've never played my game, Ultra Cards. You have played a game, maybe, that came out later called Overpower, which I didn't think was that great a game, but it has its fans. What happened is we went through a period of time where Scott and Bill negotiated things back and forth about whether they'd buy my game or not, about whether Malibu could publish the game Ultra Card separately from Overpower, and the end result was that FLIR bought my silence. They ended up buying the design and spiking it. They gave me enough money that I was able to buy some furniture for my house, which was pretty cool. It was disappointing that the game wasn't going to come out, but at the same time, it was useful to get something out of it. I got an experience. I got a check. I got stories about Bill that I still tell. I mean, it's entered my lexicon that I'm running with my shoes untied, or that I could put X-Men on this El Marco pen and sell a million copies. What do I need you for? It was my own personal Barton Fink experience. And really, it was my first experience in pitching and finding out what it was really like. I mean, I went in there armed with all sorts of details and ideas and mechanics, the things that were interesting to me. But I wasn't prepared to pitch. I had no idea how to pitch. Now we're going to flash forward years later to another story, another pitch, another life, another person doing the pitch, even though it's me. Things have changed a lot. This story now is maybe, I'll say 5-6 years ago, maybe longer now. And it was at the tail end of my working for a company called High Moon Studios, a video game developer, where we made Dark Watch and Bourne Conspiracy. They've gone on to make Transformers games, and I think they're making a Deadpool game right now. They're good guys, and I'm on good terms with them still. But at the tail end of my experience there, I was VP of design at that point. Our company had been acquired by Vivendi, so I was part of the Vivendi empire. I developed a reputation inside Vivendi for being a good pitchman, partially because I had been able to pitch the boss of Vivendi, a gentleman named Bruce Hack. I've been able to pitch him on our vision for the Robert Ludlum Bourne Conspiracy game. And there are a few properties that are harder to convert into video games than a game where someone hides all the time and runs away from violence. But I pitched it, and I think Bruce was impressed with the pitch because my name was one that came to mind when Vivendi was on the hook to pitch a game to Steven Spielberg based on the Tintin movie that he had in development at that time. So there's your scant comic book connection to the second half of the story. I had to pitch Steven Spielberg on an idea for a game about Tintin, which of course is a world-famous Belgian comic book that was in development as a major motion picture at that time, computer-generated action picture. Well, all well and good. I mean, that's exciting. Get to go meet Steven Spielberg. But here's the rub. I had 72 hours to put the pitch together. I'm not really sure how it happened. Perhaps there were people at Vivendi that dropped the ball, or people that were working on something that didn't work out, or people that were supposed to be working on something that didn't happen. But I was the cavalry. I was supposed to come in and make a pitch, and I was going up against other companies, Ubisoft, etc., that had months to prepare their pitch. In fact, when we were walking out of the pitch, Ubisoft walked right past us with development machines so that they could show a demo version of their game. There just wasn't enough time to properly prepare to pitch Steven Spielberg on Tintin. And I recognized that it was basically a suicide mission. I think Bruce knew that I could pitch, but I also figured that he knew he could fire me if I blew it. I wasn't that important to him. So either way he'd win. If I made a great pitch, then he'd save face and look smart for bringing me in there. And if I gave a lousy pitch, then he could distance himself from me and he could keep his relationship with Spielberg. And either way, Bruce would come out okay. It's just executive thinking. It's not personal. Compounding this was my usual partner on these pitches, Chris Ulm. You may remember him. He was editor-in-chief at Malibu Comics and was working with me now in video games, was my boss at High Moon. Chris's mother and father-in-law very tragically and very suddenly passed away practically the same day that we got the news about the Spielberg pitch. And Chris wouldn't be able to participate in preparation. He was going to have to be gone for the weekend, making funeral arrangements, flying off to Portland. It was just, four-alarm crisis for him. So normally I'd have Chris available as a pitch partner or somebody to bounce ideas off of. He wasn't available. It was up to me. Working with my third partner, Farzad Velaramyan. Farzad, brilliant artist, genius. That's a term I throw around like a manhole cover. But Farzad's the real deal. Farzad was a production designer on Oddworld, theatrical production designer for motion pictures, my artistic partner at High Moon. He's a partner with me still at Appy, along with Chris. And Farzad, brilliant visual artist. So that was my asset. I had Farzad. Hey, that's pretty good. But what I didn't have is I didn't have time. And I didn't have the confidence of the executives that were sending me into the room. So I was simultaneously very excited and also very angry because I felt like I was being set up to fail. And of course, it would be a dream to meet Steven Spielberg. This guy's the godfather of popular imagination of the late 20th century. And I admired his work and I admired the man. So it was with a mixture of dread and excitement that I embarked on doing this Tintin pitch, which began with figuring out what the heck Tintin was about. I ordered a bunch of books overnight from Amazon, blazed through them as fast as I could, tried to get a sense of what it was about, read everything I could about the movie. But man, what are you going to do for a pitch? You're supposed to be going in there with big concept art, with a playable demo, with a Bible of ideas, all sorts of leave behinds, expensive, brochures, and of course, the deck. What every executive has when they make a pitch. PowerPoint, pictures, little audio things, wipes. Well, I wasn't really a PowerPoint guy. And I also thought that our only hope was to do a judo flip. I thought if we went in there and tried to do what everyone else did, that our lack of preparation would shine through. Because if we're doing what everyone else is doing, you'll compare us one-to-one to what everyone else has done, and we can't help but come up short, or at least small, compared to those other pitches. I also thought that if we're all leaning back in the dark and looking up at an image projected on a wall, that I have no chance. I thought my only real opportunity in that room was me. I thought I could engage people, and I thought I could hold their attention better than images projected on a wall someplace would allow people's attention to wander. I thought if I could look them in the eye, they wouldn't look away from me, and I could tell them what was on my mind, and then maybe I could just kind of extemporize once we got into the pitch and see where it led. And I thought with my enthusiasm and confidence, I might be able to pull this thing out. So I said, no PowerPoints, no decks, and fought with Vivendi over it because they said, you have to make one. I said, I'm not going to do it. I said, well, you really should. Well, I'm not. And then the last part was my secret weapon. And that was Farzad. Because Farzad's a brilliant artist. And Steven Spielberg is also a brilliant artist. And I thought for sure, you know what? Steven Spielberg will respect a brilliant artist. And I planned to bring Farzad into the room with me for the pitch. At the last second, Vivendi refused to let him go into the room, which is a whole other story. I'm still very angry about it. I had to do the pitch without him. But I did bring his work in there with me. And that really was the secret weapon, was Farzad's work. And I thought, you know, rather than trying to develop all these finished pieces in a short period of time, let's make a virtue of a necessity. We've got to work fast and sloppy. So Farzad's going to work fast and sloppy, or at least as sloppy as he knows how to do. We went out and bought a sketchbook, and Farzad went to work, drawing like crazy, sketching ideas, and also doing versions of level layouts that I was coming up with off the top of my head. My thought was that we'd go in there just with a book, just with a sketchbook, and I'd open it up like some kind of fantastic tome. It would be like one of Leonardo's sketchbooks, full of Farzad's brilliant renderings, and our kind of half-developed ideas. And the pitch was that we respected Mr. Spielberg's genius. We weren't going to tell him what to do. We were going to show ideas of how we would do things and try to solicit his involvement in the idea. And the last part of this, my true secret agenda in going in just with this book with no technology, was I thought, this will get me close to him. I thought, I'll have this book, it's small scale, I'll open it up on a table, I'll lay it in front of him, we'll all lean in together, we'll have the same body language, we'll be leaning forward, our heads will be close to each other, we can talk in human scale terms, and we'll try to connect artist to artist. I thought that's the only way to get through this thing with our dignity intact. Crazy idea, but sometimes that's what comes down to desperation. So as far as I drew like a madman all through the weekend, I was on the phone a couple times with Chris, who was dealing with funeral arrangements and all sorts of nightmares on his end. I wasn't sleeping that much. Chris flies back, looks at what we got, has a few suggestions. We incorporate them as fast as we can. The three of us hop in the car. We drive up to LA the night before the pitch. We go out to Vivendi. And of course, we have to pitch to the bosses what the idea is going to be. They're very skeptical it's going to work. They're angry at us that we haven't made a deck. One of the producers at Vivendi, who shall remain nameless, no, he's a good guy. He probably wouldn't mind me using his name, but I'm not going to mention it anyway. He came up to us and he said, you guys are going to get killed. He was talking about Spielberg. He said, Spielberg has a reputation. Man, if you waste his time, he's an absolute monster. We've got a bet going. He said, we've got a bet going here. We have a pool. You guys have a half hour in there. We bet you won't last more than 12 minutes. That's what the it's like a lottery, you know. How long until O'Connor and Ulm and Farzad get thrown out of Spielberg's office tomorrow? And they figured that we'd last 12 minutes out of 30. Thanks, guys. Thanks for that vote of confidence. So Chris and Farzad and I went out to dinner that night. We were in Marina Del Rey someplace, and, you know, on the expense accounts, it's like order two of everything. I'm angry. You know, Chris is angry. We're all just really pissed off because we know what's going to happen the next day. We try to get some sleep. It doesn't work. Wake up the next morning without enough sleep. I find that I didn't pack a brush for some crazy reason in my toiletry kit. I ended up combing my hair with a shoehorn the day I went to meet Steven Spielberg. And we show up at the lot. He's on the lot at Universal. And there was a strike at the time, a tradespeople strike, IATSE or the Grips Union or something. And we had to cross a picket line to get onto the lot, which was, you know, made me feel like crap. But, you know, I had business. I had to go in. So I go in and we're meeting at Spielberg's office on the Universal lot. If you've ever been to Universal Studios, of course, they do a tour. They put you in a tram and they roll you around. And the office is right on the tram route. You'd never know it was there. Maybe they call it out when you roll by. But, you know, we got there a little early and we were sitting at this kind of little kiosk for the employees and eating, you know, muffins out of a vending machine or something. And the tram kept rolling by. And people are looking at me like, are you anybody? And I'm like, you know, only to my mother. So the trams are rolling by. It's very surreal. I went to Universal a number of times when I was a kid and, you know. But we're waiting for our opportunity to go in, and Spielberg's offices are there, and there's this little hacienda, beautiful offices. They're Spanish, Californian style. It's its own little compound. And boy, talk about the trappings of power. They're very human skilled, very tasteful. But there's stuff everywhere, you know, cameras from Citizen Kane and original concept art. His Oscars are there, of course, you know, designed to overawe visitors, and it was successful. So we're waiting, and it's a big team. It's me, and it's Chris, and it's Bruce, the boss, and John Melchor, who was also a producer. Producer at Vivendi at the time, was going in there to pitch a Ghostbusters game that he'd been working on. We're going to pitch a number of things, and finally, it's our turn, and we go in. And the room we pitched in was very small. So immediately when I got in there, I breathed a sigh of relief. You know, I thought I was going to be in this big cavernous room, or it was going to be behind some huge Hollywood executive desk. But instead, we were in a conference room with sort of a lozenge-shaped table that seated seven or eight people on each side. And right there in the center are Mr. Spielberg and Kathleen Kennedy, side by side, and then with their phalanx of various attendants and junior producers and assistants. And seated directly across from him are Chris and I, which is pretty cool. And, you know, the other guys in the team. And Bruce opens things up, and he talks about this, and he talks about that. I wasn't really paying attention. I was just kind of locked in. I'm sitting in the presence of Steven Spielberg. And so this guy created Indiana Jones, E.T. He was the genius behind Jaws. But, you know, I couldn't afford to get overawed about it. And as I mentioned in a previous podcast, I'm not really struck by fame. So really it was just kind of a how cool is this moment rather than a tongue-tied moment. But I also felt like I was getting ready for the Super Bowl, like I was in the tunnel and going to go out and get into some kind of full contact creative car crash. So I was pretty locked in. I was trying to concentrate, running over my pitch in my head. Again, I had nothing written down. And I figured if we get through the first 5 minutes and he doesn't kill us, we're going to be okay. But Mr. Spielberg seemed patient. And he was listening to us. He was alert. It's not like he was on his BlackBerry all the time or looking out the window or anything like that. So it comes time to talk. And here's Paul. Turn it over to me. And I must admit that I don't remember a word that I said. But I do remember a couple things. One is that the strategy worked. When I was able to show him the book and get in close, it took all the air out of the room. And everybody immediately recognized the sincerity of the pitch and the sincerity of the people that were pitching it. And when Mr. Spielberg saw the art, his eyes opened up wide because he recognized its quality and he recognized our commitment. And the pitch then was about our respect for the property and our respect for him rather than about some crazy idea that he could react to. And in this, I learned a lesson about pitching. Sometimes when you pitch, it isn't about what you're creating. The pitch is about putting something out there that people don't object to. If something's too detailed, it's a little easy for people to get hung up on details and find things that they object to. But if instead what you're giving is a real high-level vision and you're appealing to emotion and to the senses, now you've engaged someone's imagination and their heart, and they're not as likely to push back on you. So anyway, got in close with Mr. Spielberg, turned the pages, explained the game, related it back to the kind of games we're already making, tried to describe to him why we were qualified to make this game and why we wanted to make this game, why we should be allowed to make this game. It was a brilliant pitch. It went really, really well. We were supposed to be thrown out of there after 12 minutes. We were in there for an hour. We made Ubisoft wait a half hour. It was great. Now, we had no chance of getting the job, of course. It was all political. They had to listen to pitches from different companies. they were pretty certain, I think, that they were going to go with Ubisoft. Ubi was already connected with Peter Jackson. They'd done a King Kong game with him. Jackson, of course, was attached to Tintin. And to be honest, I didn't want the job. You know, if we'd gotten that job, it would have tied me to High Moon for another 3 years working on a Tintin project. I didn't have a lot of confidence, really, that was going to be a successful way to spend my career, or those years of my career. I just wanted to make the pitch. I was like Sylvester Stallone in Rocky. He just wanted to go the distance. He had no illusions that he was going to become the champion, but he wanted to go to the last round. He wanted to go out on his feet. And we got to do that. And for us, the reward was, at the end of the pitch, Spielberg came around the table and he shook our hands and he said, "Great pitch." And of course, Hollywood is a land of insincerity, but I believed him. And I think he was sincere. So, a tale of two pitches. The first one, the pitch was an utter failure. I didn't get the job. Bill threw me out of his office. The project never came to fruition. It was all very, disappointing. The second pitch, same result. Didn't get the job, but felt triumphant because we'd managed to do something very difficult. And for that hour, at least, in his day, we were able to win the respect of someone whose respect I esteem above rubies. And from both these experiences, I learned a lot. I learned to trust my instincts in talking to people about creative things. I learned that studios and powerful people bet on people as much as they bet on ideas. I learned that in making a pitch, often less is more. That often you don't want to give people things they can object to, but give them broad generalities that they can agree to. But also that the most important thing is that you're pitching yourself and your ability to execute on an idea. Because the backside of this is that the ideas really aren't that important. It does come down to execution. And that all sorts itself out after the pitch. But the pitch is the essential part of getting yourself to the point where you're allowed to execute on your idea. So, I don't know if I'll cross paths with either of these gentlemen again, with Mr. Bill Gemmis or Mr. Steven Spielberg. But I felt like I learned a lot from both of them. I like to think they remember me, or at least remember the moment when some crazy kid came in and pitched this thing or that thing. And that's my story, Tale of Two Pitches. If it didn't make sense to you or you didn't think it was relevant to the Long Box Graveyard podcast, direct your emails to Mo Christensen. You can reach him on Twitter as Mo at WeTalk, I think is what it is. Because it was Mo's idea that I come in here and tell you about this stuff. And that pretty much exhausts my story of crazy pitch tales or exciting people I've met in either the comic or the film business. That's it. That's my brush with fame. That's all I have to say. So if you listen to the Long Box Graveyard podcast for, you know, crazy true stories about famous people, you don't need to listen anymore because I'm all out. All right. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Professor Allen. And when I'm not listening to an awesome podcast, like this one, I'm co-hosting an awesome podcast, The Book Guy Show. Every week, we cover book news, book reviews, comic books, audiobooks, audio dramas, and podcasts. Search for The Book Guy Show on iTunes or come visit us at bookguys.ca.
And that's going to wrap it up for this month at Long Box Graveyard. I hope you enjoyed my Tale of Two Pitches. Whether you did or didn't, let me know. Get in touch with me. Where can you find me? Well, you can always find me direct email, which is longboxgraveyard@gmail.com. You'll find me on Twitter as @LBoxGraveyard. You'll find me on Facebook and on Google+, and on Tumblr also by those names. So it's hard not to find me. If you have a comment about the show, please write to me. I'd love to hear what you have to say. This month's plug is for Diversions of the Groovy Kind. There's a website. It's terrific. The site is diversionsofthegroovykind.blogspot.com. If you like Long Box Graveyard, you're really going to like this website. They've been you probably already know about them. They've been publishing a lot longer than I have. And Old Groove, who runs the website, specializes in publishing scanned art from Bronze and Silver Age comics, Marvel and DC, the exact wheelhouse of stuff that I handle at Longbox Graveyard. He'll sometimes do entire issues. Sometimes he'll do retrospectives, like, you know, all the splash pages from 35 years ago today, or he'll do covers. He'll do he'll draw down on artists that he admires. Wednesdays, he does a black and white feature. He does black and white Wednesdays. So check him out. Diversionsofthegroovykind.blogspot.com. It's a great read. And that will bring us to the end of this month's podcast. Thanks again for listening. Thanks to Mo and all the guys at We Talk Comics for engineering and posting the podcast. Again, let me know what you thought of this month's podcast, and I'll see you next month. Until then, I'll see you in the funny papers. Bye.
Everything must go. Going out of business, going out of business, going out of business sale. 50% off original retail price. Skip the middleman. Don't settle for less. How do we do it? How do we do it? Volume, volume, turn up the volume. You heard it advertised. Don't hesitate. Don't be caught with your drawers down. Don't be caught with your drawers down. You can step right up. Step right up. That's right, it fillets and chops and dice and slices. Never stops. Lasts a lifetime, mows your lawn. And it mows your lawn and it picks up the kids from school. It gets rid of unwanted facial hair. It gets rid of embarrassing age spots. It delivers a pizza. And it lengthens and it strengthens. And it finds that slipper that's been at large under the chaise lounge for several weeks. And it plays a mean rhythm master. It makes excuses for unwanted lipstick on your collar. And it's only a dollar. Step right up. Forges your signature. Not completely satisfied. Mail back unused portion of product for complete refund of price of purchase. Step right up. Please allow 30 days for delivery. Don't be fooled by cheap imitations. You can live in it, laughing it, loving it, swimming it, sleeping it, living it, swimming it, laughing it, loving it. Removes embarrassing stains from contour sheets. That's right. And it entertains visiting relatives. It turns a sandwich into a banquet. Being the life of the party, change your shorts, change your life, change your life, change into a 9-year-old Hindu boy, get rid of your wife, and it walks your dog, and it doubles on sacks, you can jump back, jack, see you later, alligator, and it steals your car, it gets rid of your gambling debts, it quits smoking, it's a friend, it's a companion, it's the only product you will ever need, follow these easy assembly instructions, it never needs ironing. Well, it takes weights off hips, bust, thighs, chin, midriff, gives you dandruff, and it finds you a job. It is a job. And it strips the phone company free tape tent for private exchange. And it gives you denture breath. And you know it's a friend, and it's a companion. And it gets rid of your traveler's checks. It's new, it's improved, it's old-fashioned. Well, it takes care of business, never needs binding, never needs binding, never needs binding. Gets rid of blackheads, heartbreak, and psoriasis. Christ, you don't know the meaning of heartbreak, buddy. Come on, come on. Come on, come on. Cause it's effective, it's defective. It creates household odors. It disinfects, it sanitizes for your protection. It gives you an erection, it wins the election. Why put up with painful corns any longer? It's a redeemable coupon, no obligation. No salesman will visit your home. We got a jackpot, jackpot, jackpot. Prizes, prizes, prizes. all work guaranteed. How do we do it? 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 We need your business. We're going out of business. We'll give you the business. Get on the business end of all. Going out of business sale. Receive all. Free brochure. Free brochure. Read the easy to follow assembly instructions. Batteries not included. Send before midnight tomorrow. Terms available. Step right up. Step right up. Step right up. You got it, buddy. A large print giver and a small print take it away. Step right up. You can step right up. You can step right up. Come on, step right up. Get away from me, can you, boy? Step right up. Come on, step right up. Come on, step right up.